Small is the gate and narrow the path that leads to life. Hello, Philadelphia. You're tuned in to The Narrow Path with teacher and scholar Steve Gregg on Heritage News Talk, WWDB. Over 2,000 years ago, a Jewish carpenter stood up against the powers that be and said and did things that changed the course of human history. Today, Steve will open up the phone lines to address what you would like to know about what was said and did in the Bible. Steve has nothing to sell you today, but everything to give you about what it takes to find the narrow path that leads to life. When the radio show is over, we encourage you to go to thenarrowpath.com, where you can study, learn, and enjoy with free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all the Narrow Path radio shows. We thank you for supporting the listeners-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. See you at thenarrowpath.com.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon taking your phone calls. If you have questions you'd like to raise about the Bible or the Christian faith, we talk about those things here. If you have a different viewpoint from the host and want to balance comment, we'd be very happy for you to call and talk about that here as well. The number to call is 844-484-5737. Now, there's a lot of eights and fours, and they do change their order. It's 844-484-5737. And for those of you living in Southern California, I want to remind you that this Saturday night I'm in Buena Park, which is in Orange County. I'll be giving an overview and introduction to the book of Genesis, and taking questions and answers about the book of Genesis if you have them. If you want to go through the whole Bible with us, about once a month we're going to take another book together, and I'll give an introduction to each book as we go through. That's in Buena Park at the Way Fellowship. If you'd like to know where that is, you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and go to the tab that says Announcements, and it'll tell you where and when to join us this Saturday night. All right, we're going to talk first of all today to Jason from Ontario, California. I assume it's Ontario, California, as opposed to Ontario, Canada, which would also be CA. I'm pretty sure this is Ontario, California. Hi, Jason. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome, Steve. Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
Hey, Steve, I'm hoping I can give you about a 60-second snapshot of a factual scenario, which is true, situation going on with a friend of mine. And then I have two ethical situations that I'm looking for what you think would be a biblical response or biblical approach to. Okay?
Based on this story?
Yes. Yes,
okay, go ahead.
Okay, so you have a young female who's raised in a Christian family, comes from a pastor home type background. Then you have a male that she is dating that's got a significant age gap, say about 15 years, and he comes from a Christian family as well. However, neither of these individuals are practicing Christians in their faith. I mean, they'll go to church occasionally, and they're not some other religion, but they're not practicing Christianity openly or consistently. Okay, now they started dating about 3 months ago and immediately within a month or two began to have the idea that they should live together, and they did. They moved in to live together. There was a lot of pressure put on the man by the female to marry him, despite the fact that there are major, major issues in the relationship with their past and with trust and with all kinds of issues. However, despite that, the man sort of resisted those overtures until now, as happens in these types of scenarios, there's a pregnancy. The question I have, the first question is, based on that scenario, assuming this person was, a practicing Christian or they were repentant and wanted to do the Christian thing, do they have an obligation to marry the person for the best interest of the child, even though that female is not practicing, in light of the fact that the Bible tells us not to be unequally yoked? I mean, that seems like a a situation that doesn't work out either way. You're either going to be unequally yoked or you're going to put that child in a difficult situation. So that's the first question. Sorry to give you so much here. The second question is, let's say the female has threatened to have an abortion if there's no marriage within a week. And this man doesn't even know if this child is his. That's one of the issues he has. But he's a little bit incensed at the idea that the child might get murdered here in about a week. What would you say? What, if anything, what's the biblical guidance I could give someone who might be willing to listen to biblical truth even though that person's not practicing Christianity?
You mean you're giving advice to the man or to the woman?
To the man, yes, to the man.
Well, the problem here, of course, is that neither of these parties seem to be very interested in following ethical biblical teaching in the first place, as seen by the fact that they're living together unmarried. And of course, that she wants to get an abortion. And the fact that he questions that it's even his baby makes me wonder whether she's been a little promiscuous or whether he only feels like she has been. But I would suggest that since they are not Christians, that they do not, frankly, I don't know how to give them Christian advice. I would say
right.
Because they're not Christians. You know, if they were Christians, I'd say, well, this is what the Lord would want you to do. This is what the this is what would glorify God. If I thought I knew, but the truth is, I don't know them well enough to know whether a marriage in this case would be a good idea or not. I don't believe that the mere presence of a baby means that marriage is a good idea, and especially if he's not sure it's his own. But there's no guarantee that him marrying her would be giving the baby the best life possible, especially if he lives with doubts that it's his baby, and if he's not going to give it a Christian upbringing, and neither is she. It looks like this baby's got, you know, a couple strikes against it already. But I don't know that getting married is the solution here. You know, I think these people need to decide if they want to do what's right in the sight of God in the first place. And that, first of all, would mean that they have to take God seriously. They need to take Jesus seriously. And if they're not going to do that, then I don't know that they'll take marriage seriously either. You know, I'm not interested in encouraging people to get married where there's not a very great likelihood that they'd stay married. I don't think having a divorce on your resume is good for anybody. And in fact, it may be.
You don't think biblically the fact, and I kind of agree with you, but I guess my counter is, sorry to interrupt you. You don't think biblically the fact that there's a child that, you know, now has, you know, interests that need to be considered, and perhaps an unborn child that is kind of hanging in the balance based on this threat. You still think that that doesn't justify maybe two people that aren't following God entering
well, is
into
this,
covenant?
This guy's saying, you know, if I don't marry her, she's going to kill the baby, right?
He's saying that. She's making that threat.
Yeah. I don't think anyone should get married under threats.
Yeah.
I know of a person who got married under when he was going to break up with the girl, and they had not been sleeping together, but she didn't want him to break up, and she said she might commit suicide if he broke up with her. So he married her, and it wasn't a good marriage. And so, you know, I don't think getting married under duress, under threats, is a good idea. And it may seem that if he refuses to marry her and she goes through with the abortion, that he's somehow responsible for the death of the child. I would not think so. I think that if he protests it and says, you mustn't do this, and she does it anyway, I don't think he's any more responsible for that death than anyone else who gives her counsel not to do it. Now, of course, he should have married her before he slept with her, but he didn't, and he's not even sure that it's his baby. But, you know, if he's thinking about marrying her only because it would be a heroic thing to do and prevent, an abortion, I don't know that that will prevent the abortion. And if it does, I don't know if it will prevent any other sins. You know, getting married for those reasons don't strike me as very sensible. If he doesn't want to be married to her, he should move out, and she should not be able to blackmail him into marrying her. Now, I will say this. If she was a virgin when they met, and do you know if that was the case?
I have reason to believe that's not the case.
Yeah. I mean, under the law of Moses, if she was a virgin, he should marry her, because if a man slept with a woman who'd never been with a man and they were caught, then they were required to get married. But that's because he had spoiled her virginity. Because he had now made her less under the old culture of the Middle East, made her less marriageable because she was no longer a virgin. But if she was already not a virgin and he just happened to be the last man that she messed around with, then I don't think that there's, in his situation, duty to marry. Now, maybe some of our listeners will disagree with that and they'll have better advice than I can give about that. But I have a hard time giving advice to non-Christians. I mean, I would certainly, if she would call, I would definitely tell her don't kill the baby, because people who kill babies are committing murder. And obviously, no murder has eternal life abiding in them, the Bible says. So killing babies is...
The fact that she's willing to do that suggests to me that it is a duress type of threat. I mean, whether it's true or not, the fact that you'd be willing to use that as a bargaining chip is just alarming, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it means that... if this baby goes ahead and is born, he's going to be born to a mother who is willing to kill it. And,
right.
That's not an argument for abortion by any means, but that's certainly not a good argument for marriage in this particular case. You know, if you don't marry me, I'll kill our child, which might not even be ours, but, I'll kill this child. I mean, I can see laying your life down to save another person, but getting married is a major life commitment. And if it's not the right commitment, it's probably going to not last, and it'd just be a formality. I imagine that a lot of our listeners would probably take a different approach than what I am, just saying, well, let him marry her and let the baby live and then divorce her or something like that, you know. But I don't believe in divorce. I believe you shouldn't get married unless you're going to keep your vows. And so it's a hard one. What if he says that he would take the baby or offer to support the baby if she has it?
I think she's more concerned with the bargaining chip for some reason than she is with logical thinking of the best interest of the child. I think it's a good outside the box idea. I guess I was just thinking ethically if what constraints he would have, being that assuming he contributed to that sin and to that child, you know, being born to now being boxed into to save the child. But I agree with what you're saying, that to do something heroically.
Well, by all means, if it's his child. And the child is carried to term and born, then he should take responsibility for supporting it, because he brought it into the world. He shouldn't leave the mother to support it alone. Obviously,
so to my first question, then, do you believe that it's being unequally yoked is worse than allowing a child to be born without, you know, two parents that are married?
Yeah. Well, I don't see this as unequally yoked. They're both unbelievers, right?
Well, let's say he was repentant and then said, now, do I marry an unbeliever so that I can raise this child in some semblance of a family? Do you think that's preferable or more desirable than even though you're compromising?
I think if he's repentant, what he should do, if he hasn't already, is move out and say, listen, have the baby And if, you know, if I feel like we're a couple that we should be together, then we'll evaluate that separately. I'm not going to do it under duress. I'm not going to do it under threats, under a deadline, because I don't really know that it's the right decision. We made several wrong decisions already, and making another wrong decision isn't necessarily going to improve several bad ones. But if you kill this baby, you're making a terrible decision, which you'll have to live with for the rest of your life. And just like if I marry you, I'll have to live with that the rest of my life. I think we should not make any sudden decisions that could have bring about regrets the rest of our lives. I think we should go through with the way that nature is taking its course, have this baby, and then we should continue to consider the question of marriage objectively, not while living together, but objectively, and especially once the baby's born, there'd be ways to find out if it's his baby or not, and that would be another consideration. But I don't think getting married under duress or in a hurry is ever a smart thing to do.
Well, I thank you. I appreciate your answer, Steve. I think that confirms what I was feeling. Thank you so much for your time.
All right, Jason. Sorry to hear about this situation. God bless you. Yeah, like I said, there certainly be other people who have a different outlook on this than me, and you're welcome to express it and defend it here. I'm not here to debate anything. I'd be interested in giving the right counsel, and it's a situation where I don't see a direct biblical statement to support one position or another, but I'd be interested in hearing more wisdom if other people have more than I have, and that is entirely possible. Let's talk to Bruce from Citrus Heights, California. Bruce, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you. Hey, I've made friends with a gentleman that was born and raised in India but lived in the United States for a number of decades. And we can talk about a lot of things. And recently we were talking about some theological things, and he said that he worships and honors every god just to cover his bases. And I started to explain to him that the Christian God is dishonored if you worship anyone but him. And he explained to me that in his theology, there's a guy named, or a being named Krishna that is eternal, that manifests itself bodily when there's a need arises, and one of those manifestations was Jesus. So he's worshiping Jesus, and I kind of caught off by that, and I wanted some insight.
Well, he's basically saying what the Hindus often say, and that is Jesus was an avatar, as was Krishna and other great spiritual masters, that in some senses deity took on a human form, and in that sense they would say Jesus is not at all unique. And also, of course, there is no unique God, because in the Hindu faith there are millions of gods, and so you know, neither God nor Jesus are unique in the Hindu system. There, you know, they could say, well, I believe in the God of the Christians and the God of the Muslims and the God of, you know, whoever else there is out there, because I've got room in my theology for millions of gods. And that's how the Romans were. The Romans were willing to accept the gods of other nations along with the gods they already had, because they had a bunch of them. The Jews and the Christians were the only people so stubborn that they wouldn't accept other people's gods, because they said, no, there's only one God. And you're right to tell him that it dishonors the one God to worship other gods, because the Bible says that the gods that the heathen worship are demons. It says that in Deuteronomy. It says that in 1 Corinthians. And so, you know, to worship demons who are the enemies of God, and to worship God too, is like saying, you know, I'm going to love my wife with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength. I'm going to have several mistresses that I will love with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength. Well, I'll love them all the same. Well, you can't love them all the same, because if you're going to love mistresses, you're not loving your wife. And if you're loving other gods who are demons and rivals to God, then you're not loving God. You might have affection for God, but that's not love. Love is complete respect for who he is, and eagerness to submit to him fully and to be in a covenant relationship with him uniquely, just like marriage. Now, you know, your friend isn't going to see things that way, because he's not monotheistic, and therefore he's going to see room for many avatars, of whom Jesus could be one. All I would point out to him is that Jesus didn't really allow for that. And, you know, his own theology may allow for it all he wants to, but it won't be true. It won't be in harmony with what Jesus himself said about himself, who definitely claimed to be the unique Son of God. So I would just point out to him that he has an opinion about Jesus. And by the way, almost everyone in the whole world has an opinion of one kind or another about Jesus. But not all opinions can be correct, because different opinions will contradict each other. And so you need to know, is the opinion you have about Jesus correct or incorrect? Even Jesus asked his disciples, who do men say that I am? And there were a lot of opinions. Some said Elijah, some said John the Baptist, some said Jeremiah or one of the prophets. And then Jesus said, well, who do you say I am? And Peter said, you're the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And that was the right answer. But there were a lot of wrong answers. There are many wrong answers to the question, who is Jesus? And the Hindu answer is a wrong answer. But do they care? Maybe not. A lot of people are bound to their religion for sentimental or cultural reasons, or loyalty to their own race, which has always held to a certain religion. And because of their loyalty, either racial or cultural, they won't even consider changing their religion, because they're not so concerned about whether it's true as they are concerned about whether it's loyal to their family group and to their heritage and things like that. And that's a shame. It's not everybody who cares about what's true, but everyone should. Truth is more important than anything else. in determining what to believe. And so Jesus said he was the truth. He said he was the way, the truth, and life. No one comes to the Father but through him. And that is true. If it's not true, I'd like to have someone point out why it isn't. But your friend hasn't done that. He's just made an affirmation of something else being true. And I would just point out to him that his statements about Jesus are contrary to Jesus' own statements about Jesus. And if he believes that Jesus is an avatar, then he must believe that Jesus would tell the truth and be right. It reminds me of Ravi Zacharias in a conversation he said he had while he was, I forget where he was, in Jordan or somewhere, and he's teaching at, I think he was preaching in a Baptist church or something in Jordan at one time. This is a story I heard from Ravi Zacharias a long time ago. And he and the pastor of the church, he needed some film for his camera, so you know how long ago that was, back when they had film for cameras. And they went to a camera shop in Jordan, and I think it was Jordan. The details don't matter. But, you know, the shop was run by Muslims, and the man saw that Ravi Zacharias was a man of India and thought he was Hindu. And the Muslims actually respect Hindus. And he said, oh, Hindi. And Ravi Zacharias said, no, I'm actually a Christian. I'm a preacher, and I'm preaching here in town at this Baptist church or whatever church it was. And the man said, oh, you're a Christian preacher. He says, what do you think about Muhammad? And Ravi Zacharias said he turned to the pastor and said, you tell him. And the pastor said, he asked you. And all the eyes in the store turned upon him to hear if he's going to say something to blaspheme the prophet or not. And Ravi Zacharias said, well, let me ask you this. Is Jesus a prophet? And the man said, yes, Jesus is a prophet, because Prophet Muhammad said that Jesus is a prophet. And then Ravi Zacharias said, well, can a prophet be wrong? And the man said, no, a prophet cannot be wrong. He said, well, Jesus said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life, and no man comes to the Father but by me. If Jesus is right, then Muhammad is wrong. But if Jesus is wrong, then Muhammad is still wrong, because he said Jesus was right. And that's kind of the word work with the person who thinks that Jesus is an avatar, too, a manifestation of one of the gods. If he's a god, then he must be right, correct? So if he says that he's not a god, but he says he's the unique Son of God, then he must be right. Or if he's wrong, then your theology is wrong, too, that you're saying he's an avatar, because you're saying he must be right, too. In other words, I think it's just pointing out the total inconsistency of any view of Jesus other than the view that Jesus took, other than the view that Jesus proclaimed. Unless, of course, someone wants to just say, I don't believe in Jesus at all. I think Jesus was, a liar or something like that. Well, that would be consistent, perhaps. But it's not consistent to say Jesus is an avatar, or he's a prophet, or he's a great man of God, but he happened to be lying about who he was. That doesn't make sense. So I guess I would ask the man, do you think Jesus told the truth? You know? And if he said no, then I'd say, well, I thought you said he was an avatar. Wouldn't an avatar tell the truth? And, of course, he would probably say, yes, Jesus did tell the truth. Then I would point out to him what Jesus said, saying, well, if Jesus told the truth, this appears to be contrary to your theories about him.
That's very helpful. I appreciate it.
All right, Bruce, thanks for calling. Good talking to you today. All right, Brad from Kuski, Idaho. Brad, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
A few times I've heard you say stuff about welfare, so I figured I'd call you. Yesterday you mentioned welfare.
Mm-hmm.
You actually got that wrong. You know, 20 years ago, over 20 years ago, there was what they call a 1996 Welfare Reform Act, and it ended the welfare that you refer to. There is no... Nobody in America receives welfare for sitting at home. I've heard you say that a few times. I figured I'd...
There's nobody who receives welfare who just sits at home?
No. In fact, see, it used to be called...
You have to be employed to get welfare?
Well, you have to, yes. You have to constantly be applying for jobs. But the thing is, here's what I'm talking about. They used to call that... Well, they call that cash welfare. Nowadays, but it was aid to families with dependent children.
Mm-hmm.
And that ended in 1996, and it was replaced with temporary assistance to needy families. And
okay.
And it's very temporary. And so it's not at all like it used to be. In fact, it's so difficult to be honest that it has the roles for this assistance has dropped 75% in the past 20 years.
Well, I consider welfare to include things like food stamps, too, and and certain programs like
food,
that.
Food stamps, but it isn't. Even with food stamps, you have to fill out and really do a lot of extra work. You know, so it's so difficult to get food stamps that many people don't even apply for it. So,
well, that's a surprise to me, but I appreciate you clearing that up. Of course, I don't think that had anything to do with any major point I was making, did it?
Well, I just think that Christians need to be more aware of what's really going on. In the big cities, you got serious devastation of people who have nothing, no money. I mean, millions of kids have parents that have no income. So I'm actually for the old-fashioned welfare. I know you were against it. But you know, it's funny. You obviously must be against this too, but I know Christians never bring this up. George W. Bush gave the banks $900 billion. And Barack Obama, the Federal Reserve has printed in the past 8 years $25 trillion to give to the banks.
Well, Brad, you know, you're right. I didn't know that, and I don't even know that I would agree with that. I don't think I do. But it hardly would be on a front burner issue with me. I don't pay that much attention to what governments do unless they're doing something that is manifestly a violation of moral law. Now, maybe there's some moral law violated by that. I don't even know what the issues were there because I'm not very political. When I have an opinion that's political, it's because it's a moral opinion, and I'm interested because it's a moral issue, not because it's a political one. But I know you're very politically astute and know a lot more things I don't, so I'll take your word for that. I'm going to take a break right now because some of our stations are leaving the network. We'll be coming back for another half hour, but a couple of our stations will not be coming back for the second half hour. They only take the first half hour. And for the benefit of those listeners on those stations, I just want you to know that The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry, and you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, where all our resources, hundreds of resources, are all free, but you can donate there if you wish at thenarrowpath.com. For those of you staying with us, please stay tuned for 30 seconds, and we'll be right back.
You are listening to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. The Narrow Path is listener-supported radio. After the show, we invite you to visit thenarrowpath.com to learn more. There are topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and the radio archives of all our shows. So when the show is over, come on over to thenarrowpath.com. Learn, study, enjoy. We thank you for your support, and we thank you for listening each day to The Narrow Path. We now return you to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
Welcome back to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are continuing to take calls for another half hour. If you have questions about the Bible or you have a difference of opinion from the host and want to balance comment, feel free to call. We allow both and welcome both. And even if you're not a Christian and you have objections to Christianity or the Bible, we'd be glad to hear from you today as well. The lines are full at the moment. But in a moment or two, we'll have lines opening up as calls move along. So you can take this number down and make use of it in the coming half hour if you want to call in. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Our next caller is Josh from Portland, Oregon. Josh, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thanks for having me, Steve. Real quick, if Jesus had brothers and if one of his brothers was gay and was going to have a wedding planned to marry another man, would Jesus go to that wedding and would Paul go to the wedding?
Well, first of all, of course, it's a very strange scenario since homosexuality was illegal in Israel. and homosexual marriage wouldn't ever take place. There'd be no rabbi or official that would perform one. The idea of homosexual marriage is such an innovation. Of course, homosexuality is not an innovation. It's been around for probably as long as there's been human, well, almost as long as there's been human sin. But as far as homosexual marriage, there's nobody in Jesus' day, including Jesus, that would have believed there was such a thing. It'd be an oxymoron. Basically, it'd be someone saying, I want to live in a sinful relationship that the law forbids, and I want somebody to solemnize this and call that a marriage. I don't think Jesus would do that. For one thing, he didn't believe in all marriages. He believed, for example, that if a person was divorced and had no grounds for divorce from their first marriage, that they should not remarry because that would be adultery. And I don't think Jesus would go to a wedding that was instituting what he called adultery. In other words, if somebody just left his wife, let's say Jesus had a brother. I don't know why you bring up the issue of Jesus having a brother or not about this, because Jesus did have brothers, but he didn't give them any deference that he wouldn't give to anyone else. Jesus was not someone who gave special favors to his family. As a matter of fact, when they wanted to see him, he said, who's my mother and who are my brothers? Those who do the will of my Father in heaven are my mother and my brothers. So it wouldn't matter if it was Jesus' brother or anyone else who invited Jesus to a wedding. If Jesus knew that this man had left a faithful wife and was now marrying his lover, certainly Jesus wouldn't attend that. He'd call that adultery. His teaching calls that adultery. I also don't think he'd attend a wedding if somebody was getting married to their camel or to their donkey or if they're getting married in some other illegal fashion, an immoral fashion. If they're marrying their underage daughter, I mean, certainly there are many things that the Bible would not consider marriage, and Jesus certainly wouldn't consider marriage. And same-sex marriage would have to be one of those things that are in that category because of the law of Moses, which he believed was from God.
Okay. Are you still there?
Yeah.
I'm asking because my older brother is gay, and they plan on getting married soon. And my brother's, our side of the family, most mom and me and my little brother probably have this side of the family, and we're all Christians, and we're not going.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering, well, you know, would Jesus really go? Would Paul go? Because, you know, Paul said, well, I'll be a Jew to the Jews and I'll be a Gentile to the Gentiles.
But he didn't say I'll be a fornicator to the fornicators, you know.
Yeah.
You know, now you and your family will no doubt be made to feel like you're very unloving and very, you know, rude and very judgmental because you're not going to this wedding. It's your brother who's causing the rift. You are keeping the convictions that you've always held, and which all society has always held for centuries, millennia, in fact, recognizing marriage as a relationship between a man and a woman and not anything else but that. And it's your brother who's wanting to innovate and change morals. If he wants to get married, of course, there's no reason why you should disown him or anything like that. But there's certainly no reason why he could expect you to celebrate that which you consider to be an immoral action. And marriage, going to a wedding, is a celebration. How can you be made to celebrate sin?
Yeah. That's what I was thinking. I was just wanting to get your two cents on it. I was thinking about Paul and saying that, you know, he would try to be anything just to get out there.
Well, actually, he put a limitation on that. He said, when I'm reaching out to those who are under the law, I live like one under the law. He means the Jewish law, which would include dietary restrictions and things like that, keeping the Sabbath. But they said, when I'm with those who are not under the law, then I live as one who's not under the law. He means not under the Jewish law. But then he catches himself. This is in 1 Corinthians 9. He puts in parentheses, not that I'm without law to God, but I'm under the law to Christ. Now, what he's saying is, when I'm with Gentiles, I am at liberty to not keep the Jewish law. If they want to serve me pork, I can eat pork. If they want me to help them do some work on the Sabbath, I can do that because they're without the law of Moses. I can be like that because I don't have to keep the law of Moses. But he says, I do have to keep the law of Christ. I'm still under orders from Christ. Now, I believe that Christ loves homosexuals. And if your brother goes ahead and gets married, I think that you should definitely make it clear that you still love him and that he's still your brother in the same sense that he was before. But there are things that you will not celebrate because they're not happy things. You know, that you yeah. wish your brother was more interested in pursuing the path that God made him for, because, frankly, that would be the path most happy and most fulfilling for him, and eternally rewarding too. Your brother, of course, has come under the influence of modern society as well as his own inclinations. I mean, the sexuals don't have genuine, strong desire toward the same sex. Of course they do. That's why they want to marry each other. But what if I had a genuinely strong desire toward my neighbor's wife and wanted to marry her? Yeah. Well, what? You know, I can't do that. She's off bounds. Mm-hmm. But what if I love her? Well, then I better learn to love somebody else. Or I need to learn how to love somebody without being sexual, I guess, because you don't get to have sex with everyone you love. And you don't get to have sex with everyone you're attracted to sexually. That's the way humans are made to be. Unfortunately, see, our society gave up on ordinary sexual decency long before it embraced homosexual marriage. And therefore, the homosexual community can't understand why someone would stand against their relationships when we don't stand against other relationships that are immoral. And they've got a good point. But instead of saying, oh, you're right, We haven't stood against other immoral relationships, so we better not stand against yours. Well, I think instead of that, we should say, you know, we have been inconsistent. We should be standing for morality all the time. We're not supposed to be singling out homosexuals to condemn them. How about those people who've been divorced and remarried without any grounds, and they're living in adultery according to Jesus, or people who are just living together, or people who are have several wives or whatever. I mean, there's a lot of moral misbehavior that we should be taking an equal stand against. But since the church has not been very vociferous or robust in its condemnation of divorce and remarriage, which Jesus strongly condemned, then it seems inconsistent for us to resist homosexual marriage. And I would say this: I don't resist homosexual marriage any more than I would resist any other sinful kind of marriage. And I think most of the sinful marriages that take place in this country are not homosexual, but heterosexual marriages. But I'm against all sinful marriages. I don't believe that being in love with someone or feeling lust towards someone somehow justifies marrying them and having sex with them. Obviously, if you're going to be married to somebody legitimately, hopefully you are attracted to them and love them. But that's not going to be all there is. There's got to be, qualification of that person to be your spouse. And, there's a lot of people who aren't qualified to be my spouse. In fact, there's only one person who is, and that's the person I'm married to. And no one else is qualified to be my spouse, male or female. And if I was single, there would still be limits on who's qualified to be my spouse. I couldn't, no one who's already married to somebody else could be my spouse. Nobody who's not a Christian could be my spouse. And there'd be a lot of other people I would not wish to have as my spouse, even if they were qualified. But the point is, just because you love someone doesn't mean, okay, then I should have sex with them, I should marry them. Marriage is something very specific, and changing the definition of marriage has been the greatest bane that has occurred in my lifetime in our Western civilization.
Yeah, this is poor.
It has led to many other banes.
Yeah, we got the gay pride coming up, and it's a big event.
I know.
I know it'd be illegal.
I know, Portland, Oregon, yeah.
Jesus or Paul go. I mean, you know, that we've got this. There's maybe down there and yell at them. But
I wouldn't yell at them, and I wouldn't condemn them. I would condemn, in the abstract, sinful unions, and by that I would say I don't believe that this is right. I cannot approve of this union. Okay, now, if you do something I disapprove of, that doesn't mean I disapprove of you as a person. It means I disapprove of something you're doing, okay? Unfortunately, nowadays, these snowflakes can't make the distinction between someone disagreeing with what you're doing or what you believe and, attacking them personally. That's a shame, because throughout history, people have realized that not everyone agrees about everything. And to disagree with someone doesn't mean you have to make war against them or that you have to reject them, especially in a family. I mean, there must be an awful lot of families that have some liberals and some conservatives politically in them, but they still are family. And that's, you know, obviously each side thinks the other is wrong. They disagree, but they're still family. And I believe that, you know, you can disagree strongly with what they're doing and say so. Although once they've made it very clear they don't want to hear your opinion anymore, then hopefully you've already said it plainly enough. You don't have to keep saying it. But you can certainly love them and treat them like siblings in many respects without moving into the direction of celebrating that which you think is wrong.
Yep, sounds good, Steve. Thanks for your time so much. I appreciate you.
Josh, I feel very sorry for you in your situation. I know of a case closer to home where a Christian couple's son married another guy, and they were going through a real crisis over whether to attend or not. And that's something, unfortunately, many Christians are facing right now. You asked me what I think Jesus or Paul would do, and what I think they would do is what I would do also, and that would be to kindly and politely decline. Although I'm not, of course, if these were, you know, professing Christians, I might be a little stricter about it, you know. But if they're not Christians, Paul said, what do I have to do to judge those who are outside the church? God will judge them. We need to judge those who are inside the church, and that's what we don't do enough.
Appreciate it. You know, Portland, this town's about ready to start burning books. It's really crazy around here these days.
Portland has gotten crazier and crazier. I know I lived very near Portland for 16 years. Yeah,
that's pretty wild.
Well
keep it in prayer, Steve. Thanks so much.
All right, Josh. Thanks for your call. God bless you. I hope our listeners will be praying for you in this situation and for your brother and your family. Let's talk to Bob from Lincoln, California. Bob, welcome to the Narrow. Oh, Bob's not ready to be on the air yet. So we'll take Michael from Live Oak. Oh, wait a minute here. Yeah, Michael from Live Oak, California. Welcome to the Narrow Path, Michael.
Hi, Steve. Great to hear you as always.
Yeah.
So I want to preface what I'm going to say today, that I'm in no way, shape, or form trying to whitewash the differences between the Christian path and the Buddhist path. But that being said, would you concede to a perhaps conditional similarity in that mindfulness, which now has become more well-known, and mindfulness, of course, being the basic practice of Buddhism, could you entertain that both the Buddhist follower or practitioner and the Christian disciple or a person on the Christian path, that mindfulness would be a part of their spiritual life in the sense that both are trying to discern, in the case of a Buddhist person, what is right living, what is right conduct, and so forth, and the Christian would be trying to discern what is the will of God. And that takes awareness. That takes paying attention and not just following one's whims capriciously. So,
Michael, in view of our previous discussions, which you and I have had many, I'm surprised you have to ask me whether I would acknowledge that. I've acknowledged all along that the motivations and morals and ethics of the Buddhist can be very similar to those of the Christian in many respects. I have no doubt that a Buddhist can be very sincerely seeking the right way to go, as can a Hindu or a Jew or a Muslim, or an atheist for that matter. I believe there's atheists who are seeking very sincerely the right way to live. But Christians, of course, have one difference from them all, and that is that we believe that we have found the true God in Christ, and that he has revealed himself and revealed to us the way to live. So That's the difference. But, I mean, in terms of the generic statement that the Buddhist is mindful of wanting to do the right thing, and Christians are mindful of wanting to do the right thing, which they would define as the will of God, of course. I mean, I've admitted that I've never had any resistance to that suggestion in all the times we've talked. But wanting to do the right thing is not necessarily itself the the path to life. The Bible says there's a way that seems right to a man, but the end of it is the way of death. So no matter how sincere you are, you might go down the wrong path in the woods in the dark and fall into the quicksand. You might have been very sincerely trying to go the right way, but there's still quicksand there, and you'll still die in it if you go that way. So to suggest that the Buddhist or the Hindu or atheist is seeking to do the right thing, I'll readily admit in many cases they are. But for me to say it's not a dangerous thing for them would be going further than I can go. I think it's a very dangerous thing for someone to say they're seeking the right path, but they're not listening to the right voice, and that would be the voice of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, whom God sent down to reveal what is the right path and to be the right path. And as you know very well, I believe that because we've had hundreds of conversations, you and I. But, that'd be a very significant difference. Let's talk to Bob from Lincoln, California. We're almost out of time today. Bob, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I saw you when you were here in Rockland, but in response to the guy that was speaking about the welfare, they had in place a law that said you had to be on working or seeking work for welfare, and Obama canceled that work for welfare part of the program, so they can have welfare without even seeking in work anymore. It's been changed over to that place. And as far as the food stamps, I know of one person that got off of welfare because he got a job, and the people from the food stamp people came back and solicited him to sign up again anyway so they could meet their quotas of people on there. So the system is messed up. But
I believe that
not
too.
The way he portrayed.
Yeah, well, my friend Brad from Idaho, who made that comment, he calls fairly often. He's been calling for years. He's actually a friend of mine. I know him. He usually calls to disagree with me because he's got a lot more, I guess, skin in the game than I do when it comes to political things. I'm just not that interested in politics, as I said, unless they affect morality. But he's quite, he reads a lot of political things. Though he often reads, I think, from alternative news kind of sources because, I mean, there's a lot of conspiratorial stuff involved in his views, too, some of which may be true. I don't know. I don't know about conspiracies. By definition, most conspiracies are fairly secretive, and I don't go snooping around to know very much about them. But whether what Brad says is true or not, I can't say. But in almost every time that he calls to bring some kind of correction like that, I get emails or callers like yourself saying, he was wrong about that. So I guess we get balanced comment. I don't know who's right and who's wrong. But the truth is that was not a major point of anything I was ever trying to say. So, I mean, apparently, I don't even remember the phone call he's referring to, but apparently on some phone call earlier I made reference to people on welfare who just don't work and who just sit at home. And certainly was not a main point, I don't think, that I was making, but he wanted to correct me about that.
Well, there was one point that kind of refutes what he says, that I forget which apostle it was writing to a group of believers, and he said, those that don't work don't eat.
Yeah, that was Paul in 1 Thessalonians 3:10, yeah.
Yeah, that was it.
I'm sorry, 2 Thessalonians 3:10, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, that's the point I was trying to make. Thank you much, and we'll be talking to you later.
I appreciate it. Thanks for calling. Good talking to you. All right. Bye now. All right. I have a question that was written in just the other day. Might have been just yesterday. I don't know. Where Ada wrote in and said, Hi, Mr. Gregg. I have a question. When Jesus was on the cross, he told the thief, he would be with him today in paradise. But Jesus didn't ascend into heaven until 40 days later. Can you explain this? Thank you. Well, it's true. I believe Jesus did not go into heaven that day. I believe it wasn't until 40 days later when he ascended that he went into heaven. And prior to that, his body went into the grave, into Hades. The Bible mentions that he was in Hades, although it doesn't mention anything necessarily about his soul in the sense of his disembodied state being in Hades, but there is a belief among most Christians that Hades was a place of two compartments, and that one of those compartments was where people who were righteous went when they died, and the other part was where the people who were not righteous went when they died. The rabbis spoke of the one place as Abraham's bosom, or paradise, which was the place where the righteous would go in Hades. And then the other place they referred to as Gehenna, the rabbis did. But anyway, the point is that they would suggest, and I don't know of a better suggestion than this, that when Jesus said he would be with the thief in paradise that day, that what he was saying is that they're going to go to Hades, but it'll be in that part of paradise, in that part of Hades, where the righteous go. Now, the view of most Christians, and I think it's probably correct, although it's not stated real clearly in Scripture, is that all those who were in paradise, in Hades, when Jesus rose from the dead, they left there and went with him into heaven. But when he ascended on high, at least, he led a host of captives, the Bible says in Ephesians chapter 4. And so, I don't know that anyone who's saved goes to Hades anymore in that sense. But there's a lot of things that are not explained to us, either in the Old Testament or the New, about the afterlife. And so I'm just giving you an answer that would be satisfying to most Christians. It's not something the Bible says real clearly, but that they did go to paradise, but that would be a part of Hades rather than to be confused with heaven. Carla from Torrance, California, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, this is Carla calling from Torrance. Is this?
Yes.
Narrow? Yeah. I was calling because you had a phone call earlier regarding a man who was considering whether to marry a woman who was pregnant.
Yes.
And I had a couple of other possibilities. One of them is that he could offer to support her until the baby is born and then marry her, or at least at that point the child could be adopted. The other thing is that he could marry her in faith that things will work out and see what would happen. But I think both of them need to have some in-depth counseling at this point really fast because of the pregnancy. I think he should be taking responsibility for his own actions at this point.
Yes.
And if it comes, if she leaves him or something like that, I mean, divorce is not the unforgivable sin, but I think every effort could be made to avoid it.
Okay, yeah, I think I mentioned that he should offer to support the child. And as far as his responsibility for the child, the part of the story was that he has doubts that it's his own child, that it might be someone else's child. Now, of course, he still takes responsibility because he's been sleeping with the woman. And,
yes, but even if it isn't his child, I don't know if there's a way to prove that right now, but if it isn't his child, it's still his responsibility, I think, because he slept with her to take, to provide for the child.
Sure.
And at any rate, if he does, if they do marry or something like that, that child becomes his child.
Yeah, well, that's true. So I think that's a good suggestion.
So. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks for calling today about that.
Okay. Bye-bye.
God bless you. Bye now. All right. We're just about out of time for the show, so I don't think I'll take another call. Just want to let you know, if you're not familiar, the Narrow Path website is weighted down with resources that are free to you to download, like 900 MP3 files that are of lectures. My lectures, actually, through the Bible. I ran a Bible college for 16 years and taught through the whole Bible, verse by verse, in great detail. These are in-depth studies through every book of the Bible. You can take them, listen to them, download them, put them on your device and listen to them when you're driving or whatever. anytime you want to. There's also many hundreds of lectures there on important biblical topics, in-depth coverage of topics that we can only cover lightly here when people ask about them. You can download those for free as well. And there's other resources there. Everything at the website is free. We'd like you to take advantage of it, and many thousands of people do. The website is thenarrowpath.com. Now, The Narrow Path is listener-supported. If you'd like to help us pay for the radio bills to keep us on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. It's also possible to donate from the website itself at the donations link, and also to see there where I'm speaking in the near future. I'll be speaking this weekend in Orange County, California, in Buena Park. You can find that out also at the website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow.